Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Deng-Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Thursday, June 14th, 2018. A deadly attack on boats hired to carry food on the River Nile.
They just tied. They tied your hand and your leg. From there, they throw you inside the river. You go and die inside there, inside the water.
And refugee farmers say they're having a good year, but worry about falling prices.
It was like 600, 700 per kilo. So when you calculate it, like 60 to 70,000 Ugandan currency in 100 kilogram. But this season, the prices depreciated up to like a kilo is 300 Ugandan shilling.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Eyewitnesses in Jonglei State Capital Bor say two people were killed when unidentified gunmen shot at a fleet of small boats on the River Nile Wednesday. A spokesman of the Bor-based boat trade union says the 10 boats were hired by the World Food Program to transport food from Bor to Fangak State. Dengai Deng reports for VOA from Bor.
Simon Mamut, who was on board one of the boats attacked yesterday morning, says at least 30 armed assailants drove off in a speedboat and attacked the fleet of small boats in an area 16 kilometers from Bor town.
I think it was at 3 on Tuesday night going to Wednesday. So the accident happened from there.
Guns?
Yes, they were having four guns, something like four guns here from there. They have guns. And they were having dizzy finger, so they were stopping us on the way that you stop using three language, Nuer language, Dinka language, and Arabic. And you cannot manage to see them at night. They come with a torch, they torch your eyes, so that you cannot manage to see them. You cannot recognize them by tomorrow if they take you there. You cannot manage to recognize those people. But they just tight. They tight your hand and your leg. From there, they throw you inside the river. You go and die inside there, inside the water. They tie the two guys, they throw them in the water. They ask them that, do you have money? If you say that I have money, you give them money, they still continue throwing you inside the river.
WFP spokesman in Juba, Thompson Fihiri, confirmed the attack took place early Wednesday morning. He says the two people killed are a crew member and a passenger. Thompson says the UN Food Agency is constantly in touch with all warring parties in South Sudan, calling on them to respect the work of humanitarian workers.
We renew our call for peace as well as to ensure access to humanitarian access in order to reach people in need. We appeal again to all who are in control to allow for safe passage of humanitarian commodities, so that we are able to reach those in need, especially now that this is the peak of the hunger season, when people are finding it most difficult to put food on their table.
Piri says the attack occurred north of Chambe at the stretch between Wat and Bor along the River Nile. He says the convoy was returning from delivering 197 metric tons of relief aid to people trapped by the conflict in Wat. While the boats were no longer carrying food, they had money on board. Mamosh says the attackers stole thousands of dollars and hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese pounds.
So the total amount per pound, 369,000 SSP. That is pound. Then in the dollars, they take 5,500 US dollar. That's in the dollar. Then they were having some dry fish and they were having bugs, 10 bug up closes. And then 789 dry fish pieces.
Aliu Malwal, the spokesman of the Bor-based boat trade union, condemned the attack. Malwal says this is not the first time travelers on the River Nile have been attacked in the area near Bor. Speaking in Arabic, he says at least six people have been killed around the same area this year alone.
We believe it's the same groups that have been carrying out attacks, looting, and killing people.
Malwal is appealing to government officials to deploy soldiers along insecure stretches of the River Nile to ensure the safety of travelers. Jonglei State Police Commissioner Major General Chola Tim also condemned the attack and said police are investigating the incident. And he says police will now conduct regular patrols on the River Nile to prevent similar attacks in future.
These people are causing panic on the movements of the citizens. We have a link with those of Lake of to detouring, especially that particular area. So those criminals are pursue or are chased away from that area where they used to ambush the boats.
Atim says since the police do not have a boat, it makes their job harder to pursue criminals on the Nile. Thomas Gatkwath is the Pangag State Coordinator in the Jonglei State Capital Bor.
I myself in coordinator in Pangag, I report my authority in the governor of Pangag State. I give the report the governor of Jonglei State. And the Niba Nile, you need the five governors unite. Jonglei, Pangag, Lake State, Northern League and Southern League and Terkaga. My governor, he say he will call the governor of Lake State. He talked to them. He want to make a conference for the governor's forum along the River Nile.
Pihiri says the WFP is assisting local authorities with their investigations. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Bor.
South Sudanese who are farming at the Kiryandongo refugee settlement in Uganda say they expect a good harvest this season after surviving a dry spell and an invasion of the notorious army worm last year, which destroyed most of their crops. But the refugees say a sharp drop in prices of agricultural produce this season will hurt their income and set back their efforts toward becoming more self-reliant. Simon Peter Apiku has this report for VOA from Kiryandongo, Uganda.
South Sudanese refugees, with support from relatives in countries such as the United States, Canada, and Australia, farmed more agricultural land this year, planting mostly maize, beans, and cassava, which they plan to harvest at the end of the season. The produce will feed their families. Any leftovers will be sold at market to pay for basic necessities. Igu Evans Tibi used some of the money he saved while working for an NGO to plant 15 acres of maize last year, but most of his crops were destroyed by the army worm. This year, Tibi says he expects a much better yield.
This year has been a good year in terms of sufficiency in rain. Rain has been very sufficient. And since rain is sufficient, challenges like armyworm has not been there, simply because when there's sufficient rain, that sufficient rain even kills the armyworm in their early stages.
TB says this encouraged more refugees and local Ugandan farmers in Kiryandongo district to plant more crops. But the downside of that equation is that the price of maize and other crops have dropped by nearly a half, according to South Sudanese refugee Aziz Patrick.
Previously, it was like 600, 700 per kilo. So when you calculated like 60 to 70,000 Ugandan currency in 100 kilogram. But this season, the prices depreciated up to like a kilo is 300 Ugandan shilling.
Kiryandongo district is one of the best places in Uganda to plant maize since there are two planting seasons a year. The district used to export a large quantity of produce such as groundnuts and beans. South Sudanese refugee Oni Godfrey, who has lived in Kiryandongo since the late 1980s, says exports have dwindled significantly since the fighting broke out in South Sudan in late 2013. Since that time, economic conditions have worsened in South Sudan.
Now South Sudan is blocked because of this war. We have nowhere we can sell our goods. Kenya, even my friend, the tax is too much. You cannot transport your maize from here to Kenya. That's the problem we are facing here.
The UN's World Food Programme used to be one of the biggest buyers of Kiryandongo's maize, which it distributed to refugees. But Patrick says once the WFP began distributing sorghum instead of maize to refugees, it hurt farmers like himself.
Most of the stores of our buyers are still full. So we are expecting more reduction in prices this season. So life is a little bit difficult in the settlement.
WFP spokesperson Claire Neville says the agency distributes cereals such as maize or sorghum as part of its food basket to refugees. She says the amount that gets distributed to refugees usually depends on what WFP can procure locally or regionally. South Sudanese refugees in Kiriadongo have seen the availability of arable Ugandan land for farming as a good way of becoming self-reliant, as the UNHCR and its partners struggle to feed more than 1.4 million refugees in the country, the majority of them being South Sudanese. For VOA News, I am Simon Peter Piku in Kiriadongo.
Tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A human rights group says many pregnant girls in Africa schools are discouraged from continuing their education. Find out more when we come back.
Do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
which African city would you most like to visit and why?
Johannesburg. It's really a nice place to chill in because I have a relative there and they really tell me about something like that. The beaches, the restaurants.
Bulawayo in Zimbabwe. You see, Bulawayo has got one of the rare kinds of streets. There is a street called Sorbonne Street, and it is more than 10 kilometers, and it is straight, no curve, no corner. It is just straight.
I like to visit Alexandria, the city of Pharaoh, the city where the pyramids are found.
To be there, and I be shown by a specialist the line of Equator, where it passes. That is the most reason why I like to first visit Ghana, Accra.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. An international human rights group says tens of thousands of pregnant girls and adolescent mothers are banned or discouraged from attending school across Africa. Human Rights Watch examines the issue in a 40-page report released today in advance of the Day of the African Child on Saturday. From the Kenyan capital, Ruben Chama reports.
Speaking to reporters in Nairobi, representatives from the New York-based Human Rights Group said many African governments have made strong commitments in recent years to ensure that pregnant girls and young mothers can attend school. However, countries such as Equatorial Guinea, Sierra Leone and Tanzania still ban pregnant girls or adolescent mothers from government schools. Eileen Martinez is children's rights researcher at Human Rights Watch and the author of the report.
We feel that it's very important to highlight what's happening to adolescent mothers in education because they are a highly invisible group in government policies. This is despite the fact that actually Africa has the highest teenage fertility rates in the world. And yet governments have, in some cases, managed to ensure that they include pregnant girls in their analysis. But in many cases, we have found that this is lacking and many governments are actually not including the needs of adolescent mothers.
The report provides the first comprehensive analysis of laws, policies and practices across all African Union member states that support or block adolescent girls' schooling during pregnancy and motherhood. It finds that Tanzania is among a handful of African countries that officially discriminate against young mothers as state policy. Many more countries opt to keep adolescent mothers in school, although implementation of their laws and policies frequently falls short, and monitoring of adolescent mothers' re-entry to education remains weak overall. Terry Otieno, the national coordinator of the Forum for African Women Educationalists, FAWE, Kenya chapter, explains.
One of the challenges that we have really experienced is lack of the policy enforcement. You realize that, yes, the policy is there. The schools are supposed to implement it. There's no legal enforcement whereby when a teacher has forcefully sent a girl child out of the school, what should happen to the teacher? There's nothing. in the policy that says that this teacher should be arrested or this teacher should be done this. There should be a line in the policy or a sentence in the policy that emphasizes that in case this happens, these are the repercussions.
Every year, thousands of school-age African girls become pregnant. Girls from poor and more marginalized households and communities are among the most affected. Christine Nduku is a teenage mother who resides in one of Nairobi's informal settlements. She says life has never been the same since she became pregnant and gave birth to her first child while in school.
Nilipata mtoto 2016, nikiwa na 16 years, na nilikonga primary class 8. Siku malizianga juu nilipatanga nikuwa iyo class 8.
She says, I became pregnant in 2016, aged 16 years, while doing my final year in primary school. I had to drop out of school to become a mother. I was unable to finish school. My mother is an unemployed single mother, so we just struggle to raise the child.
Niko na single mother, najiwezia na kazi, na struggling tu na mtoto.
Martinez advises African governments to urgently adopt laws and policies to ensure that schools allow and support pregnant girls to stay in school and to return to school after having a child.
One of the recommendations that we have included is that governments produce far more accurate data so that they can also understand the immensity of the challenge and how many girls are being deprived of their education, but also on the positive side, how many of them are actually staying in school as a result of good policies.
In Kenya, the government's policies prescribe that adolescent mothers should go back to school, but many girls face financial and social barriers to return. In some areas, school officials do not always follow the policies, and communities and pregnant girls are not always aware that adolescent mothers are welcome in school. This is Ruben Chama reporting for VOA in Nairobi.
Menstruation often means missed school days for many girls in Africa. But should the state provide sanitary products to girls who cannot afford them so the girls do not fall behind in their studies? That question continues to stir debate in several East African countries, especially in Kenya, where President Uhuru Kenyatta last year signed the Basic Education Amendment Act, requiring the government to provide free sanitary towels to schoolgirls. Raoul Ambour has the story for VOA. Away from Nairobi.
A 2016 UN report estimated that 1 in 10 girls in sub-Saharan Africa misses school during her menstrual cycle due to an inability to access affordable sanitary products. After 2 years of debate, Kenya's parliament voted overwhelmingly last year in favor of a measure that advocates say lifts that barrier to education. In June of 2017, President Kenyatta signed the amendment into law. This May, Gender Affairs Cabinet Secretary Margaret Kobia cleared the way for the distribution of 1 million sanitary towels to girls in Kenya's Makueni and Kitui counties. The government said it targeted more than 200,000 school girls for distribution as part of a pilot program. Through funds provided by the government and channeled through the county governments, the new law is said to benefit girls in all of Kenya's 47 counties. The government allocated $4.6 million to the Gender Department Ministry to buy the towels. Rachel Owuko is the Nairobi Program Coordinator for FEM International, a non-profit organization that provides menstrual cups and reusable washable pads to underprivileged girls in Kenya and Tanzania.
If that system can actually work very well, then it will have a great impact on school girls. First, you know that it's free education, so no girl should have an excuse or no of not going to school. And then there are free sanitary pads, so every girl would... No girl will have an excuse of not going to school just because they lack sanitary pads.
Activists around the region say the issue is most pronounced in rural areas and the problem is more complex than just supplying sanitary pads. In 2017, the UN Children's Fund estimated around 60% of girls in Uganda missed class because their schools lacked private toilets and washing facilities to help them manage during their periods. Regina Kasebe is a Uganda social worker with Action Alliance, also known as Solidarity Uganda.
Issues of women and girls like cut across nations, cut across races, and you find that in school, when these young girls, most of them, they come from poor families in the schools where we majorly work with, and the challenge they have is when it's days for menstruation, because they don't have sanitary towels, they don't even use anything, So for those days, you have to stay home. You don't go to school because you can't go to school when such a situation. So there's a missing school for the days of menstruation, but there's also the fact that they drop out, they get frustrated because they can't continue handling the same issue over and over again.
She said girls in rural areas are more likely to be married off once they have started menstruating, further contributing to dropout rates. Several African nations have taken steps to improve access to sanitary products for both women and girls. Uganda announced in 2017 that sanitary pads would be exempt from value-added tax, and in November, Kenya removed duties on raw materials used in the production of sanitary pads to help make the product more affordable. According to Sustainable Health Enterprises, an NGO, 18% of women and girls in Rwanda missed work or school last year because they could not afford to buy menstrual pads. The NGO estimates that a lack of affordable sanitary pads costs Rwanda's economy $150 million per year. Activists hope other countries in the region will follow Kenya's example and take steps to make sanitary products more accessible and thus helping girls overcome a big disadvantage they have been facing at school. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
And still in Kenya, doctors there are seeking to block the government's plan to deploy 100 Cuban doctors to fill gaps in the country's healthcare system. A group of unemployed doctors filed a lawsuit against the move, arguing that as citizens, they should have been hired first. But the Kenyan government has defied a court order blocking it from hiring the Cubans. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
Despite opposition from Kenyan doctors and sections of the public, Kenyan health officials are going forward with a plan to use Cuban doctors in the country's public health care facilities starting next month. In doing so, the government also is defying a court order suspending the employment of some 100 doctors who arrived in the country last week. A petition was filed by four Kenyan doctors. Their lawyer, Anagwe Maloba, says the doctors feel discriminated against in terms of employment and pay.
We are submitting that the decision to pay the Cuban doctors a higher or a better remuneration package than the local ones is discrimination, that they all ought to be paid similar remuneration. They all ought to belong to the same job group. The second point was that for the unemployed doctors, specialists, is that there are almost 171 specialist doctors who have not been able to secure employment to public health facilities.
Kenyan media reports say the Cuban doctors will be paid at least $8,000 each month. The doctors will also get free housing, transport and airfare. Rashid Aman is the chief administrative secretary at the Ministry of Health, and he says the Cuban doctors are needed in county hospitals.
Last 3 years, 156 medical specialists completed their studies at the University of Nairobi and Moi University, which are our two largest teaching hospitals, and were posted out to the counties. This number could not bridge the gap in health needs in Kenya.
But Edgar Washika, a lawyer for the Kenya Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists and Dentists Union, says laws were not followed in recruiting foreign doctors.
The union's interest in the matter is to safeguard the interests of this Kenyan doctors. Were this Kenyan doctors not employed and their positions that they could fill themselves, yet these positions are being offered to foreigners, obviously this does not sit well with the union and its members.
The Court of Employment and Labour Relations is expected to issue a ruling next week on the Cuban doctors. The question is, will the government heed its decision? Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The 2018 World Cup football tournament officially kicked off today in Moscow, Russia. Russia is hosting Saudi Arabia in the opening match. Toward the end of the match, the Russians were ahead 4-0. Yuri Gazinsky scored the first goal of this year's World Cup in the 12th minute for the Russians. The first two African teams, the Pharaohs of Egypt and the Atlas Lions of Morocco, will be in action on Friday. The Pharaohs are hoping Liverpool star Mohamed Salah, injured last month in the UEFA Champions League final, will be fit to play against Uruguay, and the Moroccans will meet Iran. Cameroon, Senegal, and Ghana are the only African teams to have reached the quarterfinals in the 1990, 2002, and 2010 tournaments. As Russia opens the 2018 World Cup and opens its doors to thousands of fans from all over the globe, human rights concerns linger in the background. From Moscow, Charles Maines reports.
Back in 2010, Vladimir Putin helped secure Russia's bid for the World Cup with guarantees the world would see an open and welcoming Russia. This week, Putin said Russia was finally ready for the challenge. We've done everything to ensure our guests feel at home in Russia, said Putin in a video address. We've opened our country and our hearts to the world, he said. The start of the big event, a match between Russia and Saudi Arabia. The stadiums were ready, the fan zones nearly built to completion, 32 teams competing in 11 cities. But as Russia hosts world football fans on the biggest stage of the beautiful game, human rights defenders warn the Kremlin is failing to meet one other obligation, protecting social and political freedoms at home.
The situation in Russia now with human rights is the worst it's been since the fall of the Soviet Union.
That's Yulia Garbanova, a researcher at Human Rights Watch's Moscow division. Garbanova says the Kremlin has grown increasingly resistant to international criticism over its human rights record amid a general fallout in relations with the U.S. and other Western nations in particular. Now, Human Rights Watch and other groups are calling on FIFA, the world governing football body, to enforce its own mandate and raise the issue with Russian authorities. Case in point, FIFA's decision to allow the Russian Republic of Chechnya to host a training camp for Egypt's national squad, despite an abysmal rights record under its iron-fisted leader, Ramzan Kadyrov. Rights advocates point to extrajudicial killings and the recent abduction and torture of gay men in the region, charges the Chechen leader has denied, as not only abhorrent, but in violation of FIFA's anti-discrimination bylines.
What does it mean for you to host?
Those concerns burst into the open this week when the Chechen leader corralled Egyptian star forward Mo Salah, among the world's most admired players, from his hotel bed to appear before stadium cameras in a controversial PR coup. Human rights activists say whether Salah realized it or not, the stunt worked to legitimize Kadyrov's rule. Charles Maines for VOA News, Moscow.
An update on the first match of the World Cup. Russia has just won over Saudi Arabia 5-0. And that's our show for this Wednesday. We leave you with the song La Suba by Victoria Olay. Listening to Victoria Olay with the song La Suba. I'm Ayen Dengbior in Washington, and I thank you for listening. We'd like to hear what you think about our show. Send us your comments on the web to southsudan@voanews.com, or you can find us on Facebook. Our title is South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.